Naturally speaking.
Coming to you live from Lecture Theater 2 in the Graham Kerr. This is a Naturally Speaking podcast. We've had a bit of a hiatus over the summer. Seems like just yesterday we were saying this about the summer before that. But it is actually pretty difficult to get together and do these podcasts during the summer because there's so many people off traveling and things. I should say before we go any further, I'm here with, I'm Sean Killen. I'm here with...
James Buckley. And Daryl McLennan.
Yeah, Daryl's joining us. We have 50% fewer Jameses than we normally have on the podcast here. Daryl was with us on the last podcast we did.
Yeah, it was a bit of a special one.
Yeah, providing an insight into the zombie physiology.
Yeah.
Is it? It was very factual.
The response, the fans just went wild.
They did.
For Daryl.
Fans? So, plural?
Yeah, well, I think our subscriptions for our blog went from 7 people. I think it skyrocketed to something like 11. So we can only assume it was due to...
We can only try and reverse that now.
But no, so yeah, we have Daryl back with us here today. Today we're going to do one of our sort of research roundup editions of the podcast where we kind of summarize some of the recent research that's been going on by people in our institute. But like I was saying earlier, we want to do these more often, ideally at least once a month, if not once every couple weeks. But we need ideas for things to talk about.
And people.
We actually do have quite a few sort of ideas on the slate for things to talk about. But yeah, more importantly, it's people. Like, it'd be nice to get some fresh blood in here, like Daryl. Once people get sick of Daryl, we'll need, once the insanity online for Daryl dies down, they'll want someone new.
I'm sorry, you may be sick of myself, but... No one else at the moment.
That's true. So if anyone wants to come on and have a chat with us about the research or any other aspect of science, really, we thought the zombie thing was actually a lot of fun, just as a platform to talk about science in general. So anything like that, we're totally open to ideas. But today, yeah, we're just going to go through, briefly summarize some work. Each of us have sort of brought in a paper to discuss by various researchers throughout the Institute. So we'll talk about 3 different papers here today. I don't know if you just want to go around, and James, do you want to go first? Open things up?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, we just want to clarify that there were so many papers published in the last half year or so
that we missed.
That we may miss a lot of very exciting papers. But these are some of the ones I think that are just caught our eye and were a bit different to some that we've done in the past. So I looked at a paper which I hadn't really heard much about this, but it sounds very interesting, and I think it should have got... It probably got some media attention, I imagine. It's about enhancing the egg's natural defense against bacteria by increasing cuticle deposition, i.e. making the eggshells thicker.
So what sort of eggs?
Patience, Sean. Patience, Sean. These are chicken eggs, if you wanted to know. And this is a paper published by Maureen Bain in the Institute and in the Journal of Animal Genetics, and quite recently, actually, for change. We actually are quite up to date with this, I think. But essentially, the paper is looking at a particular group of hens, a sort of a pedigree, so sort of that's where you know the paternity and maternity of all the offspring in that group. And it's a group of hens that have been used for egg laying, and essentially they're looking at variation, so natural variation in the cuticle thickness or deposition, as they call it, within this group. And they just wanted to see how that affected the ability of the eggs to resist bacterial entry, or bacteria getting in, and they wanted to see whether this trait was actually heritable, i.e. is there genetic variation within this population for this particular trait? And if so, then you can potentially select for thicker cuticles to better resist bacteria. And given that there are many sort of infectious diseases and bacterial-driven infectious diseases that may be transmitted, through between different hens or vertically from the mother to the thickness of the cuticle may be quite important. So essentially this paper... It's very interesting. They used a whole range of techniques, and I won't go into the exact details of it. We'll put the papers on the blog so that you can find a bit more detail yourself if you're interested. But essentially, they used a range of techniques such as reflectance spectrum, so looking at the sort of the eggshells and post and pre staining, and they did that, and they could estimate basically the extent to which the thickness or the amount of deposition of particular sort of proteins and substances within the cuticle. And then from that, they got this trait, the cuticle thickness, and essentially they could then look to see whether within this group, whether there was variation. And they did find that there was a heritable variation in this trait. So essentially that means that mothers and offspring. There's some degree of relationship between the cuticle thickness of the mother and the offspring. And it wasn't massively high, but it's enough that you could potentially, it could potentially drive selection. You could artificially select for thicker cuticles in hens. And one of the nice things about this paper was that they did then look to see whether this trait would actually be important. And as I said, mentioned earlier, they actually tested to see whether within this population, they took the, some of the ones with the worst cuticles and some of the ones with the best cuticles as such, and looked to see how well bacteria got into them. And they found that the ones with the worst cuticles allowed, consistently allowed bacteria, such as E. coli in this case, a sort of particular strain of E. coli, to get through. And the ones with the best cuticles consistently stopped the bacteria getting through.
You don't want E. coli in your
You don't want E. coli eggs. In your eggs. So basically they suggested that that would be a really, it's a, it shows that there's something there, a trait of interest that varies within populations. And is, I think it's been basically ignored because all the hens are in, so in a sort of a laying population, they're all in sort of a controlled environment. There's no need to have thicker hen shell, egg shells. You know, they can just be allowed to sort of be as thin or thick as they like. But in the wild, for example, there tends to be much stronger selection for thicker eggshells in environments where there's a risk to the eggs.
Right.
So it's interesting that, you know, this trait has been ignored, but it may be useful and find form a basis for selection to improve resistance to bacteria.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, the bit in the paper, in the introduction, when they talk about how in the wild there is variable thickness depending on sort of the harshness of the environment. I don't know, did you come across, like, are there, what are the trade-offs involved? Like, why wouldn't you just want, like, a really thick shell? I guess there's parental investment there, but...
They did mention that, well, one of the trade-offs in terms of hens, for example, is hatchability. I think that if you have more cuticle deposition producing a sort of thicker, tougher egg shell, then it may make it harder for... chicks to hatch.
Poor little chick is trapped in there.
Or people to crack their eggs into frying pans. I don't know. I'm not sure if a, I'm not sure if a thicker shell would be better for that purpose or not. Yeah. So
is there perhaps some sort of perfect thickness?
There might be, maybe there's a sort of, you don't want to get them as thick as possible, but you want to get them sort of like to a certain optimal thickness. Trade-off between a...
The Goldilocks of
egg thickness. The Goldilocks of egg thickness, exactly.
Yeah, you don't want to break your pan, like cracking the egg on there. That would be bad. Need a hammer.
There's also some interesting aspects looking at the proteins in the eggshell as well, and saying that some of them were associated with, sort of potentially associated with the sort of reducing bacterial penetration. And they suggest that there's, they found sort of like a range of, I think, six proteins that were identified in the eggshells and have been identified in other studies as well. So some of these proteins may actually have a antimicrobial sort of thing as well. So it shows that the eggshell really is a very important aspect of resisting bacterial infection.
So not only is it a physical defense, it's also a chemical defense as well.
I think people know it's sort of, you know, it's partly there as a sort of means to stop water getting in, but allowing air to sort
of move. Well, that's the other side of it too, that could be a trade-off as well, I guess. I have no idea, but maybe the thicker it is, the more difficult it is for gas exchange across the shell, potentially, that could be another trade-off.
They do suggest that, again, some of these other trade-offs, it sounds great to do that, but you need to experimentally determine whether there are trade-offs and whether, if you select for this trait, so increasing cuticle thickness as such, or resistant cuticle ability to resist bacterial entry, whether this will have an impact on other traits. It doesn't seem to have an impact on, like, the... reproductive side or other important traits, such as the amount of eggs they lay, or
it doesn't affect.
It didn't really have much effect within this group. But again, I think more sort of experimental work is required to sort of truly test whether the other effects that we mentioned, such as the ability of eggs to hatch, and you said the ability of, you know, the future fitness of the chicks, where that might be influenced.
Cool. It's definitely something you don't really think of when you're sitting down and having breakfast. Yeah.
I'm in the supermarket and I'm opening the box to see if any of the eggs are cracked, I might actually start taking along some kind of compact cuticle thickness measuring device to make sure that my eggs are as E. coli free as possible.
Well, it's true. It could have an impact there.
I might patent that, actually.
Yeah, we should probably just edit this out. You don't want anyone stealing that idea.
No. Yeah. This won't make the final edition.
Okay, so shall we move on? So I guess I'll talk about my the paper that I found. So this is a paper in Biology Letters by Colin Selman, who's a new faculty researcher in our department. Came to us from Aberdeen, and this is actually a paper that he worked on with some of his colleagues up in Aberdeen. And I won't read the title yet because I think it's actually a spoiler for some of the results that they found. I don't want to ruin the suspense here. I find that a lot of papers these days actually have kind of spoilerific titles. They kind of give the conclusion.
Why bother reading it?
You know? Yeah. And like someone reads a title to you, you're like, oh, great. No, I was really excited about that paper. And you've ruined it for
me. To be fair, I'd rather not have to read the abstract of every paper to find out if they had such a cryptic title that I couldn't understand a word.
But it is like having a novel and putting the twist on the front page.
Yeah, or like a movie if you just immediately gave away the twist in the title.
He's a ghost.
it was Kevin Spacey all along. Anyway, so I won't read the title just yet, but they were looking at antioxidant defenses and how that affects lifespan and aging in a mammal, in this case, the short-tailed vole. You know, it's all the rage these days, much like Daryl's online popularity. But why do we age? Can we stop aging? People don't want to get old and wrinkly or prevent them from eventually dying. A bit too depressing here, but so there's a lot of concern over, you know, what causes us to age. It's really interesting to think about too, like why don't all organisms just live forever? You know, from a fitness perspective, that would be awesome, just keep living and pumping out babies. but we all organisms seem to senesce and get older, and one of the leading theories about why organisms age is this free radical theory of aging, or the oxidative damage theory of aging. And this basically, the idea behind this is that over time, there's cumulative damage to the building blocks that make up your tissues, like proteins, lipids, even your DNA.
What sort of things cause damage?
These free radicals that are caused as a byproduct. Yeah, they're radical. And they're free. They're generated as a byproduct of just cellular metabolism. So as your cells are producing ATP, if you think back to your undergrad days, the electron transport chain, there's different reactive oxygen species especially that are created as a byproduct there. And they can kind of run amok in your cells and cause damage to different tissues in the DNA as well. Your body has all kinds of defenses against these reactive oxygen species, sort of antioxidants that are already in place that your body has. But there is a proportion of these that will evade capture, cause damage, and that accumulates over time, causing you to age, get old and wrinkly, and eventually die. Because of this, the idea has caught on that what happens if you eat a bunch of antioxidants in your diet? Does that boost your body's sort of defenses against these things? And so that's really caught on, all these creams and things you can put on your face to prevent aging.
So antioxidants, what sort of supplements would you sort of consider to be antioxidants?
Well, specifically what they looked at in this paper is a lot of vitamins, for example.
Okay.
And so in this paper, they were specifically looking at supplements with vitamin E and vitamin C. And they were testing the idea, do supplements with these vitamins enhance lifespan in short-tailed voles? And it's interesting, this idea has really caught on despite there being very little evidence that these antioxidants actually help extend lifespan or even, you know, work against or work to soak up these oxygen-free radicals that are floating around in your system.
I did like, I said, this is it's a sort of an idea that had been applied to a range of systems, I think, already, but so it's not been applied as often as it to sort of animals in the wild. And so I think that's quite neat. So it's comparing sort of, or looking at things in a lab device, in a lab mammal.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this work is done with sort of model species, like strains of lab rats or yeast or these sorts of things. So this was a wild caught population of voles, although they were brought into the lab and reared in the lab. But yeah, it was with a wild drive population. So they brought these voles into the lab. From 1 month of age, they split them up into different treatments, whether or not they were going to be receiving a supplement with vitamin E, vitamin C, or just a control diet that they would be compared to. And then they also did this at two different temperatures, 7 degrees and 22 degrees, because endotherms, when it's colder, you have to use more energy to keep yourself warm. And so they thought the results might be stronger there, the production of free radicals and the benefits of the antioxidants. So they basically tracked these voles throughout their whole lives, basically waited for them to die on these different into supplements. And so what did they find? So this is a bit I didn't want to get away. So, you know, did they find that these supplements increase lifespan? The answer is, what do you guys think? Well, you've read the title.
Given the title, I imagine it's not quite what you expected.
They found that not only did it not increase their lifespan, it actually, the supplements decreased the lifespan of these voles in both temperatures. So supplementation with vitamin E or vitamin C drastically decreased the lifespan of these rats. So the maximum lifespan was around 1,000 days in the controls, and it dropped to around 500 or 600 days in the supplement group. So that's a pretty drastic drop.
So don't feed your mice and hamsters at home.
If you have a short-tailed vole at home, do not give it vitamin supplements.
Well, that's the interesting thing, because it seems to be species-dependent. Because I think Colin Selman's worked on mice before.
Right.
And he found the opposite. He found that vitamins increase lifespan.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the take-home messages from the paper, is that the effects of these antioxidants seem to be hugely variable among species. You know, whether or not they actually act to soak up these free radicals. But also, in some cases, there seem to be side effects of taking these antioxidants. So they talk about how affects insulin sensitivity in humans, for example, antioxidant supplementation. In some circumstances, in some species, supplementation with vitamins seems to cause more reactive oxidant species and damage to be produced. So there's all kinds of...
Quite a complicated picture.
Yeah, it's definitely a more complicated story than the original sort of free radical theory of aging would have you believe. Because the other thing along with this is there were these drops in lifespan with antioxidants, but they did actually find evidence that there was a reduction in oxidative damage to liver hepatocytes, their lipid content, or lipids in the liver. So it does seem that they were having an effect on antioxidant or oxidative damage, but it actually decreased lifespan.
So perhaps this free radical theory of aging is not quite as critical for all organisms as
people might. Well, the consensus seems to be that oxidative damage has some role in aging, but the free radical theory of aging definitely seems to be more complicated than was originally kind of put forth in the 90s when that really caught on in the ecological literature.
I'd like to know about humans. Should I take my vitamins? Should I not?
Well, I mean, based on this, they recommend that...
If I was a mole, I definitely would not be taking my supplements.
Well, they warn against sort of the promotion of, you know, this antioxidants for use in humans. So, I mean, don't go too crazy with it. The other interesting side effect is that long-term doses with things like vitamin supplementation... actually, there seems to be evidence that it decreases the body's own endogenous defenses. I'm not sure to what extent that happens in humans, but for things like mice that are on long-term supplemented diets, they seem to, their body's own defenses against these things kind of go into the bin.
Probably best is to keep on eating fruit and veg regularly.
Yeah. And wine. Wine has that.
Wine.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah,
gin
definitely
tonic
get
with
enough.
A slice of lime.
Yeah.
Okay, Daryl, do you want to
talk
about what you've brought in for us here today?
So I was reviewing a paper by Tim Burton, who's a postdoc in the Institute, and also a colleague, but I won't let that interfere with my judgment. This was published earlier in the year, in March 2013, in Ecology. So in basics, what Tim and co were interested in was maternal characteristics and how this affects offspring in wild Atlantic salmon. So they measured a number of current characteristics, for example, somatic condition of the mothers. But even more interesting is...
me pouring coffee, not peeing. Sorry, Daryl, go ahead.
That's okay. What I find especially interesting was that they were also looking at early maternal experience and how this affects offspring.
So by early maternal experience, is that...
So specifically in this paper, they were looking at growth rate in early life of the mothers and how this affects offspring. So just for a bit of background, Atlantic salmon in Scotland tend to migrate to sea in spring, but to do this they have to reach a sort of a minimum size. So if they're fast growing, they do this within 2 years and migrate to sea after 2 years. But slower growing individuals have to wait till the following spring. So what this results in is two different populations. You have salmon that have spent 2 years in freshwater, and you have salmon that spend 3 years in freshwater. So Tim found that for a given size, these slow early growing mothers produce relatively larger eggs and also relatively larger fry.
But the slower growing mothers.
The slow early growing mothers, yeah. But interestingly, not only were the fry larger, but they also had a slower growth rate as well. So it looks like these slow early growing mothers are producing offspring that will also spend 3 years in fresh water. So I get, if you were a slow, well, if you were a salmon, a female salmon, and you wanted to give your offspring the best possible chance in life, do you think it'd be best to be a slow early grower or a fast early grower?
So the fast early growers, they produce smaller eggs, but do they produce more eggs? Is it a trade-off between size and number? Different strategies?
I'm not sure.
And is it a heritable thing, or is it...
It seems to be. Okay. It seems to be that these slow early grow mothers are producing offspring that are also...
But that could be sort of a maternal effect of hormones or something that the eggs are exposed to as well. It could... Personally, it's not necessarily a genetic thing.
I think Sean's thinking... I think personally, I just... Not a big fan of being out in the open ocean, so I spend longer in the rivers, so yeah. I'd be a slower one.
Good.
Is that right? Yeah.
Well.
3 years in the rivers.
It depends. In this case, in this study, they found that the offspring from the slow, early-growing mothers had a higher survival rate. But that doesn't mean that that's necessarily best. It just means in that particular river system, the slow, early-growing mother offspring are preferred. And in fact, we all know that different ecological conditions favour different offspring. And previous studies have found that slow, early-growing salmon are found more in high-altitude streams, whereas fast, early-growing individuals are found in more food-rich, low-altitude streams.
So adapted to different environments, possibly?
Possibly. And in fact, the author, along with his colleagues, are conducting a follow-up study where they are taking salmon from the same families and planting them in high-altitude and low-altitude streams.
Old transplant experiment.
Exactly. So it'll be interesting to see what they find.
So you're involved in some of these as well? Because you and Tim are in the same lab.
I have been helping in the field.
Okay.
Although I have to say it does leave a bit of a bad taste in my mouth because most of it involves walking up mountains.
Okay.
With buckets of eggs to reach these high-altitude streams.
Yeah, the hiking part actually sounds pretty cool. But
and then when you get
buckets
there,
of eggs
when
and
do
water.
You, when do you do this? What
well,
time
exactly,
of year?
It's in February, so most of the streams are frozen over.
Oh my God.
So not only do you have to take up a bucket of eggs, you also have to take a sledgehammer.
Okay.
Which isn't fun to carry up a mountain.
So you're dumping these eggs into a freezing cold river.
We're not dumping, we're strategically placing these eggs in artificial nests.
I'm always starting to feel sorry for them a bit.
No, they're loving it.
Who, also, for Daryl and Tim going
no,
up
for
the
eggs, for
okay.
the eggs. Yeah. Yeah.
And because we have to use streams that no other salmon exist in, it means they have the entire stream to themselves.
Nice.
So how do you ensure that? Do you just pick streams that have no salmon to begin with, or you do go in and like...
Exactly. Well, we work with fisheries trusts, and they identify streams that have natural migration barriers.
Okay.
So even though these streams are perfect salmon environments, the salmon aren't able to reach them.
Right. Okay. No, it's a really cool idea, just the whole maternal effects thing, that your mother basically starts to affect you.
Exactly.
Affect your life before, not only before you're even born, but this is saying when she's a juvenile, she's already affecting your life.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's not it's just genetics as well. So people often forget or don't think about the fact that genetics is a small component of what get passed on to the next generation. And there's also a strong sort of amount of environmental influence. And part of that environment is the environment in which your mother is part of.
It's crazy. So is it an adaptive thing then? Like the growing conditions that the mother has experienced, is she somehow changing the growth trajectories of her offspring because that's an adaptive thing?
I'm not sure
about that.
It worked
for her. So.
Yeah, exactly. And because salmon often return to the same river that they were raised in, it looks like they are giving their offspring the best possible chance by producing offspring that they know will be adapted to the river system that they're going to grow up in.
On a negative side for science, this does mean that things are going to get more and more complicated. So it's even harder to learn and study things in the field because you've got, as well as I said, complex genetic effects, you've got complex environmental influences on things. So studying sort of adaptation of organisms to the environment.
It's a complex thing.
It's a very
science.
Complex thing. It's difficult, and that's what we're trying.
It's too complicated. It's going to give up and go home.
It'd be interesting to see if you could cross this over into humans as well. Because there's a bit of a stigma about staying with your parents until quite a late age. But maybe, in fact, you're giving your offspring the best possible chance.
Yeah, so if you spend more time... with your parents, if you grow slower.
And they say, get out. You say, Mum, I'm just giving
I'm
your
thinking
grandchild
of my future
the best
kids.
Possible
yeah,
chance.
Yeah, so they will also live with their parents until they're into their 40s, but they'll be more laid back about it.
Yeah, this could revolutionize humankind.
Mum, I'm not moving out because I found this paper that says that salmon that grow slower end up being better off.
I think it has the potential to be a really wonderful fable as well.
In what way? Like sort of like another Goldilocks thing?
Exactly. As human beings, we're constantly rushing. We're rushing to leave home. We're rushing to finish our experiments to get the papers published. But it shows that you don't need to do that. Take your time. It'll pay off.
We can learn a lot, really.
If you're in a high altitude stream.
It's really a lesson for all of us. It is. Kind of slow down, enjoy life, produce big
it's
eggs.
It's changed my outlook in life.
Thick cuticles.
I'm not going to do much work today. I'm going to take it slower. Thanks, Tim.
But I think that does it for another edition of Research Roundup. Well done, guys.
Yeah, it was fun.
Find those papers, bring them in. We hope to do this a little more often in the future, like I say. Like we were talking about at the beginning.
Yeah. I was going to say, do let us know if you have a paper coming out and you're interested in getting it highlighted on this prominent podcast.
Yeah, if you want to alert the media.
Please do let one of us know, because we really would like people to be engaged and contribute to this, because it means it's not just us.
Yes.
Talking all
yes.
the time.
Blabbering on. all right, guys. So that'll do it. That's it for another Research Roundup. Until next time, which will be relatively soon, I'm Sean Killen.
I'm James Buckley.
And I'm Daryl McLennan.
Over and out.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook, you can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.